Excerpt from the Notebooks of Leonard Aquirm. Consideration of the Great Bird. That a man may fly to the edges of the world and beyond, I find that if this instrument be well made and hurled with sufficient force over the endless rim, it will put a ring around the world, and the first flight of the great bird to the summit of Monte Celesti will fill the universe with wonder. The cabin for the crew is sealed against egress of air. The cabin may detach and float should the great bird land in the sea. Should I add extra dragons to allow it to fly home alone should this arise? Memory to self, no. If the fixed wings of wood and canvas are contrived to change their shape in accordance with the wishes of the steersman. When the bird finds itself within the wind, it can sustain itself above it without beating its wings. By means of capstans and strings under tension, my wings will take any shape desired, both for gliding and stooping de plano, when the wings will be in folded position, the better to countenance the resistive forces of the air. There are to be cradles for dragons, for the propulsion caused by the flames thereof. These pods allow steering through the thin air during our passage around the world. I recall my pleasure upon seeing a fish eagle stoop upon a salmon in a lake, and then, upon rising again, turn the salmon in its talons so that the head of the salmon was facing forwards. For it demonstrates that the air and water are, in their currents and pressures, both fluids of a kind, which cause the denizens to develop certain similarities of form the better to navigate these fluids. The great bird is this eagle. Between its talons it grips the salmon of thunder. The tail section powers the assemblage beyond the fractious air currents of the rim for the first part of the voyage, and then detaches. The body of the salmon of thunder is segmented to allow array after array of male dragons to be induced to flame by the mirror mechanism by which each beast is shown its image in a looking-glass, whereupon its natural protective instinct impels it to flame defensively. Each segment is then discarded in turn. If crew and cargo were reduced, the bird could carry barrels of explosive powders, ephebian fire, and other instruments of war to rain terror upon enemy cities without fear of retaliation. Happily, no government would ever allow such madness, and the flights of many birds could only bring international peace and brotherhood. The lights of the anchored ships disappeared into the murk as the barge drifted on, faster now as the current began to pull. "No turning back now," said Leonard. There was a roll of thunder, and fingers of lightning walked along the edge of the world. "Just a squall, I expect," he added, as fat drops of rain thudded on the tarpaulins. "Shall we get aboard? The drag lines will keep us pointed directly at the rim, and we might as well make ourselves comfortable while we wait."
"We ought to release the fireboats first, sir," said Carrot.
"Silly me, yes," said Leonard. "I'd forget my own head if it wasn't held on with bones and skin and things." A couple of ship's boats had been sacrificed for the attempt on the circumfence. They wallowed slightly, laden as they were with spare tins of varnish, paint, and the remains of the dragon's supper. Carrot picked up a couple of lanterns and, after a couple of tries in the gusting wind, managed to light them and place them carefully according to Leonard's instructions. Then the boats were cast adrift. Freed of the drag of the barge, they pulled away in the quickening current. The rain was hammering down now.
"And now let us get aboard," said Leonard, ducking back out of the rain. "A cup of tea will do us good."
"I thought we decided we couldn't have any naked flames on board, sir," said Carrot.
"I have brought along a special jug of my own devising which keeps things warm," said Leonard.
"Or cold, if you prefer. I call it the hot or cold flask.
I am at a loss as to how it knows which it is that you prefer, but nevertheless it seems to work." He led the way up the ladder. Only one small lamp lit the little cabin. It illuminated three seats, embedded among a network of levers, armatures, and springs.
The crew had been up here before. They knew the layout. There was one little bed further aft, on the basis that there would only be time for any one person to be asleep. String bags had been stapled to every bit of unused wall to hold water bottles and food. Unfortunately, some of Lord Vetinari's committees, devised in order to prevent their members from interfering with anything important, had turned their attention to provisioning the craft. It appeared packed for every eventuality, including alligator wrestling on a glacier. Leonard sighed.
"I really didn't like to say no to anyone," he said. "I did suggest that nourishing but concentrated and low-residue food would be preferred."
As one man, they turned in their seats to look at the experimental privy Mark II. Mark I had worked, Leonard's devices tended to, but since a key to its operation was that it tumbled very fast on a central axis while in use, it had been abandoned after a report by its test pilot, Rincewind, that whatever you had in mind when you went in, the only thing you wanted to do once inside was get out. Mark II was as yet untried. It creaked ominously under their gaze, an open invitation to constipation and kidney stones.
"It will undoubtedly function," said Leonard, and just this once Rincewind noted the harmonic of uncertainty. "It is all just a matter of opening the correct valves in sequence."
"What happens if we don't open the right valves in sequence, sir?" said Carrot, buckling himself in.
"You must appreciate that I have had to design so many things for this craft," Leonard began.
"We'd still like to know," said Rincewind.
In truth, what happens if you don't open the right valves in sequence is that you will wish that you had opened the right valves in sequence," said Leonard.
He fumbled below his seat and produced a large metal flask of curious design.
"Tea, anyone?" he said.
"Just a small cup," said Carrot, firmly.
"Make mine a spoonful," said Rincewind.
"And what's this thing hanging in the ceiling in front of me?"
"It's my new device for looking behind you," said Leonard. "It's very simple to use. I call it the device for looking behind you."
"Looking behind you is a bad move," said Rincewind, firmly. "I've always said so. It slows you down."
"Ah, but this way we won't slow down at all."
"Really?"
said Rincewind, brightening up. A squall of rain banged on the tarpaulins. Carrot tried to see ahead. A gap had been cut in the covers, so that the...
"By the way, what are we?" he said. "I mean, what do we call ourselves?"
"Possibly foolish," said Rincewind.
"I meant officially."
Carrot looked around the crammed cabin.
"And what do we call this craft?"
"The wizards call it the Big Kite," said Rincewind. "But it's nothing like a kite. A kite is something on a string which..."
"It has to have a name," said Carrot. "It's very bad luck to attempt a voyage in a vessel with no name."
Rincewind looked at the levers in front of his seat. They had to do mainly with dragons. "We're in a big wooden box, and behind us are about 100 dragons who are getting ready to burp," he said. "I think we need a name.
Do you actually know how to fly this thing, Leonard?"
Not as such, but I intend to learn very soon."
"A really good name," said Rincewind fervently.
Ahead of them, the stormy horizon was lit by an explosion. The boats had hit the circumfence and burst into fierce, corrosive flame.
"Right now," he added.
The real kite, is a very beautiful bird," said Leonard. "It's what I had in mind when I..."
"The kite it is, then," said Carrot firmly.
He glanced at a list pinned in front of him and ticked off one item.
"Shall I drop the tarpaulin anchor, sir?"
Yes, do that," said Leonard.
Carrot pulled a lever. Below and behind them there was the sound of a splash, and then of cable running out very fast.
"There's a reef! There's rocks!"
Rincewind stood up, pointing. The firelight ahead glowed on something squat and immovable, surrounded by surf.
"No turning back,"
said Leonard, as the sinking anchor dragged the kite's coverings off like an enormous canvas egg. He reached out and pulled handles and knobs like an organist in full fugue.
"Number one, blinkers down, tethers off. Gentlemen, each pull those big handles beside you when I say."
The rocks loomed. The white water at the lip of the endless fall was red with fire and glowing with lightning. Jagged rocks were a few yards away, hungry as a crocodile's teeth.
"Now, now, now! Mirrors down, good. We have flame. Now, what was it? Oh, yes. Everyone hold on to something!"
Wings unfolding, dragons flaring, the kite rose from the splintering barge and into the storm and over the rim of the world. The only sound was a faint whisper of air as Rincewind and Carrot clambered off the shivering floor. Their pilot was staring out of the window.
"Look at the birds! Oh, do look at the birds!"
In the calm, sunlit air beyond the storm, they swooped and turned in their thousands around the gliding ship, as small birds will mob an eagle. And it did look like an eagle, one that had just snatched a giant salmon from the fall. Leonard stood entranced, tears running down his cheeks. Carrot tapped him very gently on the shoulder.
"Sir, it's so beautiful, so beautiful."
"Sir, we need you to fly this thing, sir, remember? Stage 2?"
"Hmm?"
Then the artist shuddered, and part of him returned to his body.
"Oh, yes, very well, very well."
He sat down heavily in his seat.
"Yes, to be sure, yes. We shall test the controls, yes."
He laid a trembling hand on the levers in front of him and placed his feet on the pedals. The kite lurched sideways on the air.
"Whoops! Ah, now I think I have it. Now I think...
Rincewind, flung against the window by another judder, looked down the face of the rimfall. Here and there, all the way down, mountain-sized islands projected from the wall of white water, glowing in the evening light. Little white clouds scudded in between them, and everywhere there were birds wheeling, nesting, gliding.
"There's forests on those rocks. They're like little countries. There's people. I can see houses."
He was thrown back again as the kite banked into some cloud.
"There's people living over the edge," he said.
"Old shipwrecks, I suppose," said Carrot.
I think I've got the hang of it now," said Leonard,
staring fixedly ahead.
"Rincewind, please be so good as to pull that lever there, will you?"
Rincewind did so. There was a clunk behind them, and the ship shook slightly as the first stage cage was dropped. As it tumbled slowly apart in the air, small dragons spread their wings and flapped hopefully back toward the disk.
"I thought there'd be more than that," said Rincewind.
"Oh, those are just the ones we use to help us get clear of the rim," said Leonard, as the kite turned lazily in the air. "Most of the others we'll use to go down."
"Down?" said Rincewind.
"No, yes. We need to go down as quickly as we can. No time to waste."
"Down? This is not the time to talk about down. You kept on talking about around. Around is fine, not down."
"Ah, but, you see, in order to go around, we need to go down, fast."
Leonard looked reproachful.
"I did put it in my notes. Down is not a direction with which I am happy." "Hello, hello," came a voice out of the air.
"Captain Carrot," said Leonard, as Rincewind sulked in his seat.
"Oblige me by opening the cabinet there, will you?"
This revealed a fragment of smashed omniscope and the face of Ponder Stibbons.
"It works!"
His shout sounded muffled and somehow small, like the squeaking of an ant.
"You're alive?" "We have separated the first dragons, and everything is going well, sir," said Carrot.
"No, it's not!"
Rincewind shouted.
"They want to go down!"
Without turning his head, Carrot reached around behind Leonard and pulled Rincewind's hat down over his face.
"The second-stage dragons will be about ready to burn now," said Leonard.
"We had better get on, Mr. Stibbons."
"Please make careful observations of all,"
Ponder began, but Leonard had politely closed the case.
"Now then," he said, "if you gentlemen will undo the clips beside you and turn the large red handles, you should be able to start the process of folding the wings back in. I believe that as we increase speed, the impellers will make the process easier."
He looked at Rincewind's blank face as the angry wizard freed himself from his hat.
"We will use the rushing air as we fall to help us reduce the size of the wings, which we will not require for a while."
"I understand that," said Rincewind distantly. "I just hate it."
"The only way home is down, Rincewind," said Carrot, adjusting his seatbelt. "And put your helmet on."
"So, if everyone would once again hold tight,"
said Leonard, and pushed gently on a lever.
"Don't look so worried, Rincewind. Think of it as a sort of, well, a magic carpet ride."
The kite shuddered and dived. And suddenly the Rimfall was under them, stretching to an infinite misty horizon, its rocky outcrops now islands in a white wall. The ship shook again, and the handle Rincewind had been leaning on started to move under its own power. There was no solid surface anymore. Every piece of the ship was vibrating. He stared out of the porthole next to him. The wings, the precious wings, the things that kept you up, were folding gracefully in on themselves.
"Rincewind!" said Leonard, a blur in his seat.
"Please, pull the black lever." The wizard did so on the basis that it couldn't make things worse. But it did. He heard a series of thumps behind him. 50 of dragons, having recently digested a hydrocarbon-rich meal, saw their own reflections in front of them as a rack of mirrors was, for a moment, lowered in front of their cages. They flared. Something crashed and smashed back in the fuselage. A giant foot pressed the crew back into their seats, the Rimfall blurred. Through red-rimmed eyes they stared at the speeding white sea and the distant stars, and even Carrot joined in the hymn of terror which goes, Leonard was trying to shout something. With terrible effort, Rincewind turned his huge and heavy head and just made out the groan,
"White lever!"
It took him years to reach it. For some reason his arms had been made out of lead. Bloodless fingers with muscles weak as string managed to get a grip and tow the lever back. Another foreboding thump rattled the ship. The pressure ceased. 3 heads thumped forwards. And then there was silence, and lightness, and peace. Dreamily, Rincewind pulled down the periscope and saw the huge fish section curving gently away from them. It came apart as it flew, and more dragons spread their wings and whirled away behind the kite. Magnificent! A device for seeing behind you without slowing down. Just the thing no coward should be without.
"I've got to get one of these," he murmured.
"That seemed to go quite well, I thought," said Leonard. "I'm sure the little creatures will get back, too, flitting from rock to rock. Yes, I'm sure they will."
There's a strong draught by my seat," Carrot began.
"Ah, yes, it would be a good idea to keep the helmets handy," Leonard said. "I've done my best, varnishing and laminating and so forth, but the kite is not, alas, completely airtight. Well, here we are well on our way," he added brightly. "Breakfast, anyone?"
"My stomach feels very—" Rincewind began, but stopped. A spoon drifted past, tumbling gently.
"What has switched off the downness?" he demanded. Leonard opened his mouth to say, no, this was expected, because everything is falling at the same speed, but he didn't, because he could see this was not a happy thing to say.
"It's the sort of thing that happens," he said. "It's, magic."
"Oh, really? Oh." A cup bumped gently off Carrot's ear. He battered it away, and it disappeared somewhere aft.
"What kind of magic?" he said.
The wizards were clustered around the piece of omniscope, while Ponder struggled to adjust it. A picture exploded into view. It was horrible.
"Hello, hello, this is Ankh-Morpork calling."
The gibbering face was pushed aside, and Leonard's dome rose slowly into view.
"Ah, yes, good morning," he said. "We are having a few teething troubles."
From somewhere off-screen came the sound of someone being sick.
"What is going on?" bellowed Ridcully.
"Well, you see, it's rather amusing. I had this idea of putting food in tubes, you see, so that it could be squeezed out and eaten neatly in weightless conditions. And because we didn't tie everything down, I'm afraid my box of paints came open, and the tubes got confused. So what Mr. Rincewind thought was broccoli and ham turned out to be forest green.
Let me speak to Captain Carrot, will you?"
"I'm afraid that is not entirely convenient at the moment," said Leonard, his face clouded with concern.
"Why? Did he have the broccoli and ham too?"
"No, he had the cadmium yellow."
There was a yelp and a series of clangs somewhere behind Leonard.
On the brighter side, however, I can report that the Mark II privy appears to function perfectly.
Excerpt from the Notebooks of Leonard of Quirm. On creatures real and imaginary inhabiting the void.
On Draco Stellaris Nauticae, the star voyaging dragon. This vast dragon trawls debris from the void with its gaping maw. Using normal dragon digestion, it compresses this debris and turns into gases. These flame through the ventral orifice, propelling the dragon with considerable force. The wings are tiny and vestigial. So vast is the beast that smaller dragons voyage by attaching themselves to its hide. Oh, what a cosmos that has such creatures within it! On Aphodius Maximus, the giant dung beetle, witnessed during the flight of the great bird, very similar to the solar dung beetle of Gelibabian mythology, it forms its dung into small planets. It appears to have various igniferous orifices for propulsion in the void, in a manner similar to the Hershebian bombardier beetle. As below, so above. Mirabile dictu. On Bora imaginaris horridis, or imaginary hull borer, this, as yet undiscovered but greatly feared, creature may have evolved from squid washed over the rim of the disk. It employs a spike with rotating teeth for first piercing and then enlarging a hole in the spaceship's hull, into which fluids may be injected to dissolve the contents. It is possible that a gas bag at its tail end is used for propulsion and that it possesses tentacles for gripping. It is also possible that the creature is imaginary. Note, if such a creature invades the ship, it is vital that the crew split up in order to search for it. Nucleus situm ex orbita unus certis maximus.
The kite, in its headlong plunge, curved back towards the rimfall. Now the water was a great tumbling cloud of mist. Captain Carrot hovered in front of a window, taking pictures with the iconograph.
"This is amazing," he said. "I'm sure we'll find the answers to some questions that have puzzled mankind for millennia."
"Good. Can you get this frying pan off my back?" said Rincewind.
Said Leonard. It was a sufficiently troubling syllable for the others to look at him.
"We seem to be, losing air rather faster than I thought," said the genius. "But I'm sure the hull isn't any leakier than I allowed for. And we seem to be falling faster, according to Mr. Stibbons. It's a little difficult to piece it all together, of course, because of the uncertain effects of the disk's magical field. We should be all right if we wear our helmets all the time."
"There's plenty of air near it to the world, isn't there?" said Rincewind. "Can't we just fly into it and open a window?"
Leonard stared mournfully into the mists that filled half of their view.
"We are moving very fast," he said slowly. "And air at this speed... air is... the thing about air... Tell me, what do you understand by the words shooting star?"
"What's that supposed to mean?" Rincewind demanded.
That we die an immensely horrible death."
"Oh, that," said Rincewind.
Leonard tapped a dial on one of the tanks of air.
"I really don't think my calculations were that ro—"
Light exploded into the cabin. The kite rose through tendrils of mist. The crew stared.
"No one will ever believe us," said Carrot eventually.
He raised his iconograph towards the view, and even the imp inside, which belonged to a species that was seldom impressed with anything, said, "Gosh!" in a tiny voice as it painted furiously.
"I don't believe this," said Rincewind, "and I'm seeing it."
A tower. An immensity of rock rose from the mist, and looming over the mist, huge as worlds, the backs of four elephants. It was like flying through a cathedral thousands of miles high.
"It sounds like a joke," Rincewind babbled. "Elephants holding up the world? And then you see it?"
"My paints! Where are my paints?" mumbled Leonard.
"Well, some of them are in the privy," said Rincewind.
Carrot turned and looked puzzled. The iconograph floated away, trailing small curses.
"And where's my apple?"
he said.
"What?"
said Rincewind, perplexed at the sudden subject of fruit.
"'I'd just started eating an apple, and I just rested it in the air, and it's gone!'
The ship creaked in the glaring sunlight, and an apple core came tumbling gently through the air.
"'I suppose there are just the three of us aboard,' said Rincewind, innocently.
"'Don't be silly,' said Carrot. "'We're sealed in.
So your apple ate itself?'
They looked at the jumble of bundles held in the webbing behind them.
"'I mean, call me Mr. Suspicious,' said Rincewind. "'But if the ship is heavier than Leonard thought, and we're using up more air, and food is vanishing, you're not suggesting that there's some kind of monster floating around below the rim that can bore into wooden hulls, are you?' said Carrot, drawing his sword.
"'Ah, I hadn't thought of that one,' said Rincewind. "'Well done.'
"'Interesting,' said Leonard. "'It would be, perhaps, a cross between a bird and a bivalve, somewhat squid-like, possibly, using jets of—'
"'Thank you, thank you, thank you, yes!'
Carrot pulled out a roll of blankets and tried to look back along the cabin. "'I think I saw something move,' he said, "'just behind the air reservoirs.' He ducked under a bundle of skis and disappeared into the shadows. They heard him groan.
"'Oh, no!
What? What?' said Rincewind. Carrot's voice was muffled.
"'I found a... it looks like a... skin.'
"'Ah, fascinating,' said Leonard, sketching on his notepad. "'Possibly, once aboard a hospitable vessel, such a creature could metamorphose into—' Carrot emerged, a banana skin kebabbed on the end of his sword. Rincewind rolled his eyes.
"'I have a very definite feeling about this,' he said.
"'So have I,' said Carrot. It took them some time, but finally they pushed away a box of dishcloths, and there were no more hiding places. A worried face looked out of the nest it had made.
"'Ook!'
it said. Leonard sighed, laid aside his pad and opened up the omniscope's box. He banged on it once or twice, and it flickered and showed the outline of a head. Leonard took a deep breath.
"'Ankh, more pork? We have an orangutan!'
Cohen sheathed his sword.
"'Wouldn't have expected much to be living up here,' he said, surveying the carnage.
"'There's even less now,' said Caleb.
The latest fight had been over in the twinkling of an eye, and the cleaving of a backbone. Any creatures that ambushed the horde did so at the end of their lives.
"'The raw magic here must be huge,' said Boy Willie. "'I suppose creatures like this get used to living off it. Sooner or later something will learn to live anywhere.'
"'It's certainly doing Mad Amish good,' said Cohen. "'I'll swear he's not as deaf as he was.'
"'What?' "'I said you're not as deaf as you were, Hamish. "'There's no need to shut one.'
"'Can we cook 'em, do you think?' said Boy Willie.
"'They'll probably taste a bit like chicken,' said Caleb. "'Everything does if you're hungry enough.'
"'Leave it to me,' said Mrs. McGarry. "'You get a fire going, and I'll make this taste more like chicken than chicken.'
Cohen wandered off to where the minstrel was sitting by himself, working on the remains of his lute. The lad had brightened up considerably as the climb progressed, Cohen thought. He had completely stopped whimpering. Cohen sat down next to him.
"'What are you doing, lad?' he said. "'I see you found a skull.'
"'It's going to be the sound box,' said the minstrel. He looked worried for a moment.
"'That is all right, isn't it?'
"'Sure. Good fate for an hero, having his bones made into an harp or something.' "'It should sing out wonderful.'
"'This will be a kind of lyre,' said the minstrel. "'It's going to be a bit primitive, I'm afraid.'
"'Even better. Good for the old songs,' said Cohen.
"'I have been thinking about the saga,' the minstrel admitted.
"'Good lad, good lad. Plenty of spakes.'
"'Yes. But I thought I'd start off with the legend of how Mazda stole fire for mankind in the first place.'
"'Nice!' said Cohen.
"'And then a few verses about what the gods did to him,'
the minstrel went on, tightening a string.
"'Did to him? Did to him?' said Cohen. "'They made him immortal.'
Yes, in a way, I suppose.
"'What do you mean, in a way?'
"'It's classical mythology, Cohen,' said the minstrel. "'I thought everyone knew he was chained to a rock for eternity, "'and every day an eagle comes and pecks out his liver.
"'Is that true?'
"'It's mentioned in many of the classic texts.
"'I'm not much of a reader,' said Cohen. "'Chained to a rock? For a first offence? He's still there?'
"'Eternity isn't finished yet, Cohen.'
"'He must have had a big liver.'
"'It grows again every night, according to the legend,' said the minstrel.
"'I wish my kidneys did,' said Cohen. He stared at the distant clouds that hid the snowy top of the mountain.
"'He brought fire to everyone, and the gods did that to him, eh? Well, we'll have to see about that.'
The omniscope showed a snowstorm.
"'Bad weather down there, then,' said Ridcully.
"'No, it's thormic interference,' said Ponder. "'They're passing under the elephants. "'We'll get a lot more of it, I'm afraid.'
"'Did they really say, "'Ankh more pork we have an orangutan?' said the Dean.
"'The librarian must have got on board somehow,' said Ponder. "'You know what he's like for finding odd corners to sleep in, "'and that, I'm afraid, explains about the weight and the air. "'I have to tell you that I'm not sure that they have enough time or power "'to get back onto the disc now.'
"'What do you mean, you're not sure?' said Lord Vetinari.
"'I mean, I am sure, but no one likes bad news all at once, sir.'
Lord Vetinari looked at the big spell that dominated the cabin. It floated in the air. The whole world sketched in glowing lines and, dropping from one glittering edge, a small curving line. As he watched, it lengthened slightly.
"'They... "'Can't just turn around and come back?' he said.
"'No, sir, it doesn't work like that.'
"'Can they throw the librarian out?'
The wizards looked shocked.
"'No, sir,' said Ponder. "'That would be murder, sir.'
"'Yes, but they may save the world. One ape dies, one world lives. You do not need to be a rocket wizard to work that out, surely.'
"'You can't ask them to make a decision like that, sir.'
"'Really?'
"'I make decisions like that every day,' said Lord Vetinari.
"'Oh, very well. What are they short of?'
"'Air and dragon power, sir.'
"'If they chop up the orangutan and feed him to the dragons, won't that kill two birds with one stone?'
The sudden iciness told Lord Vetinari that once again he hadn't taken his audience with him. He sighed.
"'They need dragon flame to—' he said.
"'To bring their ring path over the disc, sir. They have to fire the dragons at the right time.'
Vetinari looked at the magical orrery again.
"'And now?'
"'I'm not quite sure, sir. They may crash into the disc, or they may shoot straight out into endless space.
"'And they need air?'
"'Yes, sir.'
Vetinari's arm moved through the outline of the world, and a long forefinger pointed.
"'Is there any air here?' he said.